This podcast is brought to you by SDBullion.com. They've been friends of mine for over a decade. I trust them with my business. You should too. Visit SDBullion.com for more information. Hello again, everybody at TFMR. And welcome to your midweek conversation here, the last week of April 2026. I'm bringing back an old friend today because the last week of April 2026 reminds me a lot of the last week of January 2020. There are parallels that I'd like to discuss with Chris Martinson. Again, we've known Chris for about as long as there's been a TFMR. He, of course, runs peakprosperity.com and also peakfinancialinvesting.com. I always introduce him as the smartest guy I know. And so why not pick his brain a little bit about where we are and where we're headed? Chris, my old friend, thank you for your time this morning.
Craig, always a pleasure. I'm sure this is going to be a ripping good conversation, as it always is.
Would you do something for anybody that, for whatever reason, doesn't know who you are, your background? I'm just kind of lay that on us real quick. What is Peak Prosperity? What is Peak Financial Investing? And anything else you want to throw in?
Yeah. So background, I'm a scientist. I'm a data guy. I like logical things. I'm also a Renaissance guy. I do a lot of different things sort of okay, but put it all together. And I think I've got a pretty wide range of talents, right? And so what I do is I connect dots for my audience, and there's a couple of dots that need connecting. But when you go through it and you look at where we are economically with debt and how money is created, and then you connect that to energy, which is the thing that keeps that whole system humming, we're going to talk more about today. And you put those two pieces together, you go, oh, wow, our money system's completely unsustainable. And so to cut way to the chase, I say to people, plant a garden, which is sort of shorthand for saying this could get pretty funky. I think people should be resilient. So my whole life's work is about being resilient. In a Peak Financial side, we also think people need to be connected with financial advisors who see the world the way they do and who understand the actual risks that we're facing right now. And they're magnificent. And I think a lot of people are starting to detect that. So, that's kind of a quick background.
I'll put those two links on this page so everybody can check it out. I've always kind of described Peak Prosperity as a lot like TF Metals Report, only more so. You do a better job. You go into more detail than my ADHD riddled brain can handle. And so please, everybody, I mean, they're almost like we have sister sites in a way. Be sure to check out peakprosperity.com, especially at a time like this. All right, brother. So here's what's been on my mind. We've been watching this now. As we record this, it's April 28th. I just kind of dawned on me as I was introducing this. That's significant for two reasons. One, this whole fiasco in the Middle East began exactly 2 months ago today on February 28th. So that's one, number 28. I also remember, I think it was January 28th, which is my birthday. On January 28th, 2020, you and I, and I was figuring this out by following you and talking things over with you. But on January 28th, 2020, you and I record a podcast attempting to warn everybody on this site and anybody that would listen that this COVID thing was going to be effed up. This was not something you can just brush aside as a cruise ship problem or, you know, look at those crazy Asians running around their masks again. You were talking about, remember the R-naught values? Before we figured things out, you know, starting to get that data by about May that maybe, you know, the younger you were, you know, and you were going to be okay and the preconditions and everything out. But you remember when there were like R-naughts of like 5 and all that stuff? And we were wondering, where was this? And it almost had the feeling that the world, not just the investment world, just in general, your neighbors, were just kind of ho-hum, this is no big deal. And you and I were like, no, this is going to be a real problem. And 6 weeks later, everybody figured it out. So here we are. This has been on my mind now because it's the same but different. This war has been going on for 2 months. I think this is going to be a real problem eventually. But everybody's just like, no big deal. You know, it's all right. It doesn't really affect me. Chris, that's a long question. But am I kind of in the ballpark here? And is this going to be a big deal? And how will this impact people?
It's you're well within the ballpark, except I'm going to have to make this ballpark really big, because this is 10 times worse than people are imagining, I think, on average right now. It's way worse than COVID. And so COVID was really human decisions, right? Some humans got together and said, let's stop flying and all this stuff, right? And just to rewind that clock, it was right around the end of January. I started noticing something really odd, which is that, there was this mass virus outbreak happening in China, and China had shut down all of its domestic flights out of Wuhan, but they hadn't shut down any international flights. And the WHO came out and said, oh, it would be racist for people to say we
Right.
shouldn't have flights from China. I was like,
Right.
what?
What are you talking about?
What? So it was easy to predict that this high R-naught respiratory virus was going to sweep the world because they were flying it out of Wuhan all over the world. It was like the easiest thing ever to predict. I don't even want to call it a prediction. It was just like an observation.
Yeah.
Like, of course that's going to
Yeah.
happen. Same thing today.
Yeah.
So oil is the master resource. So I like to walk people through this. So a lot of people think, oh, the United States economy is decoupled from oil. Oh, we're energy independent. None of those things are true. What we did in the United States is we exported our manufacturing to China principally, but other places too. And that's where the energy gets consumed. And then we import that as finished products, but we're still using the same energy. So when you look at the world economy, this is the best chart I have in all of economics, which can be a little loosey-goosey. You have to squint at things. You don't have to squint at this. This is a straight line on a chart, which asks and answers, if an economy is this big, how much oil are they consuming? And it's like this straight line relationship. The bigger your economy, the more oil you're consuming. And it makes sense, right? If you forget about like this beautiful cityscape at night and you see the traffic jams in LA or whatever you're looking at, or the shipped containers coming in and out of the port of Los Angeles, you just look at this. And if once you put on your energy goggles, I call it, all I see is just it's diesel mostly, and it's bunker fuel for ships and it's jet fuel. That's how our economy moves stuff. And that's how you know it's running. If you saw no flights in the sky, well, we wouldn't be having that part of the economy working. If you saw no trucks on the road, well, that'd be a disaster, because things would shut down in about 3 days. But once you start to see it this way, you understand, okay, energy is the economy. Great. So right now, the world is missing about 14.5 million barrels a day of oil and finished products out of the Gulf. It could be as high as 25 if they shut down some of the other, pipelines. There's various ways they can still sneak stuff out of there without going through the Strait of Hormuz. But here's the interesting thing. If you ask and answer the question, when was the last time the world was consuming 14 and a half million barrels of oil per day, less than we are today? When was that? So I get out my little straight line chart and I look at it and I draw a line back and I say, oh, that was 2011. Things weren't bad in 2011. I like 2011, good year. But the world economy, Craig, was 36% smaller in 2011. So that's where we're headed,
Yeah.
unless this resolves real soon. We can talk about maybe why that's not going to happen in a second. But right now, people aren't feeling it because we had two big buffers in this story. One, we have onshore inventories, and two, we had what were called floating inventories, because oil comes out of the ground, gets put in some tanks, it gets loaded onto some ships, and they sail around the world, right? So, about April 20th, the last of those floating ships landed. So, whoops, we're kind of out of those.
Yep.
Okay. And now we're eating into onshore inventories, and there's not that many of them. The United States is currently hammering the price of oil to keep it under 100 for political reasons. But you know what happens when you keep oil cheap relative to the rest of the world? People come here and buy it. Our inventories in the United States are getting absolutely raided right now. We have rats in the cupboard. I mean, it's happening. And there's only so long we can do that before we get scared and we do what China's already done and Russia's already done, which is they start resource hoarding. They've made it illegal, or they banned the export of finished petroleum products from their countries. And that's where we are in this story, that people haven't quite felt it yet. Totally. We're January 2020 on this story.
And the market is responding as if it's a supply shock, which obviously it is. But all of the it, not just the crude oil, all the precursor chemicals to plastics and the liquefied natural gas and the fertilizer and the helium and everything else that goes through there. And like I said, as everybody starts to gate in, which is a natural response, gate in your own resources, it becomes not a supply shock. It becomes a demand shock, a global economic slowdown that takes center stage. And am I connecting those dots right? I mean, it almost has to play that, just like the COVID thing. And almost you're going to fly all these people around the planet that are already sick. It's going to spread. Aren't we seeing this layout? Can't you kind of see over the horizon how this is coming? Are we looking at this right?
Well, absolutely. And this is what makes it so difficult to sort of like put into words quickly. I'm preparing this whole report. It's gotten away from me, as they tend to do, because there's so many things to talk about.
Yeah, I'm
It's a
sure.
poly crisis. The helium alone is a crisis. The missing sulfur is a crisis.
Yeah, that's
The
another.
missing naphtha is another crisis. The missing precursor chemicals, another crisis. The missing oil, of course, a crisis. The missing LNG, a crisis. Each of them's a crisis. You put them all into one spot and you go, oh, okay, here's what's going to happen. When we're really close to actual shutdowns of refineries in the Asian Rim just for lack of product at this point in time, because you can't run them at 10%, you can't run them at 40%. You have to. They're either on or off, mostly with a little bit of buffer in there. But they're going to have to start shutting refineries down. And when they do, well, then if Singapore does that, Singapore is a major refining center. If they shut down, well, then there's no bunker fuel or ship fuel in that region anymore. And so ships won't be able to go there unless they have enough on board to go there and come back again, right? So
Yeah.
this is going to very quickly morph into that problem. Two, we know that the Fed's already printing right now. It's a shock. So of course, what do? You print. You can see it in the so-called markets, with the S&P in the rolling 10-day average is not just moved up slightly strongly for anybody listening. It is now in what's called the 100th percentile of all such moves throughout all of history. It's never had a more powerful move over the rolling 10-day average. It's the number one. Now, why is that? Is things that good? You and I both know it means there's liquidity being poured into the markets from somewhere, right? And the Fed has admitted to some printing. They don't call it QE, it's reserve management, reserve balance management, but it's printing. And now we have to begin to wonder if there aren't other sort of invisible hands in there. And people are really, Craig, really openly questioning the stuff you and I have talked about forever. But like we
Right.
saw the invisible hand in the silver markets forever. Now people are going, this oil market doesn't trade like it should, and these are seasoned people, right? There was an article in Bloomberg the other day. It was an opinion piece, but they were quoting the CEO of Diamondback Energy who said, the futures market is lying to us, right? That's about
Right.
as
I
strong as
saw
you can
that.
get in the business, So that's what they're doing. They're trying to maintain the illusion of calm, but underneath, every million barrels that's not there is a gigantic future supply shock. It's going to turn into what will have to be a demand shock because we're missing the precursors. Polyethylene, polystyrene prices go up because of those go up. Everything downstream from that goes up in price. I will be surprised if in 1 or 2 years we're not at like high double digit inflation, 15, 18, maybe 20%, because that's where this is going.
And if you're managing your business too, I mean, you can't build your product without, all of the components. And if one of them is going to be in short supply, well, you know what? We're going to cut back production. Oh, you know what? We better factor that into our business plan for next year. And we're not going to hire as many people. We're not going to expand like we thought. And you draw that out globally, and now we're in a, I mean, stagflation might be
Kind.
too kind of a term.
No,
So,
it's absolutely coming, and this is just turning into such a doomer podcast, but this is the
well, but
world
it
we live
is.
in,
Yeah.
and also at the same time, we're watching this just unbelievable destruction of what we would call high-paying IT jobs because of AI, but that's
Right.
spreading rapidly, right? So in the United States, we're going to be facing record levels of federal debt, also record levels of just comprehensive debt across our economy. I think it's 106 trillion now. And we're facing the prospect that students have some of the lowest hiring rates coming out of college, and seasoned people are getting laid off, and it's just getting started, and nobody has a plan for this. There's nothing other than let's just build data centers as fast as possible and like completely dismantle a multi-hundred-year-old arrangement of money and work and meaning and purpose. it's just going to just shred our culture. And I don't see anybody talking about this who has any sort of what I would call gravitas, wisdom, statecraft right now on the national stage. We're
Yeah.
just going to make it happen as fast as possible. And that's crazy. It's insane. Or it's intentional.
Well, now now that's another part of it, right? We talk about these markets. The term you'd use in our prior discussion was silver, crude getting silvered. There was, as we record this on Tuesday, there was a $3 1 minute candle in silver. How many contracts did you see go? I mean, in crude. How many contracts did you see go by in that 1 minute, Chris?
6,000 contracts, just under 6,000, but we'll call it, we'll round up, call it 6,000. And it's 1,000 barrels of contracts. So that's 6 million barrels of oil got dumped in a single 1 minute, shredding $3 off of the price of oil. That's not a market. That's not price discovery. That's called price setting, which we're used to, right?
Yeah, we've
That
only
is a
seen that a million
fiction.
times. We've only seen that a million times over the last 15 years, haven't we? Oh, good heavens. All right, so
You can't do that with oil. I mean, silver, okay, because we have
yeah.
inventories and you can shuffle shelves for a while and do that. But oil is different. Craig, oil, we take it out of the ground and then we set it on fire, right?
All
It's a
right.
constant, it's a very delicate balance of stocks and flows, right? So
Right.
we just had this huge erasure of flows in the Middle East, right? And we're eating through the stocks. And
Yeah.
so for it to be treated like silver just means it's somebody, I'm just going to guess here, somebody in power said, oh, we know how to control markets. What do you need politically? We need to keep a lid on all of this because this will all be over soon, somehow. And so they held that fiction and they started monkeying with the markets. If you monkey with the oil markets, here's the problem. You set the price too low in the United States. Oh, we're under 100 here. It's 140, elsewhere in the world. Great. You know what happens? People come over here and they buy it. So I think 7.3, almost 7.4 million barrels came out of our SPR, so-called Strategic Petroleum Reserve, but it's actually a strategic political reserve. And we took that out and sold it to people. So we're eating our seed corn here to try and keep a lid on oil prices because somebody thinks this is going to be over soon. I don't see how it could be. These two negotiating parties are about as far apart as you could be. It's going to take a long time to resolve this, and there's not a chance in the world the U.S. can forcibly reopen the strait. It's just a question of geography and logistics and where the drone technologies and anti-ship missile technologies are. You can't do it. So
Don't you feel though that that's what everybody is just kind of like, yeah, it's going to be fine. They'll just start, it'll just stop one day and everything. What did that Qatarian gas field that they share with Iran, they knocked off 20, it was going to 3 to 5 years to rebuild the 20% that was taken offline in that missile attack
Yeah.
last month. You've got the ongoing attacks from Ukraine into Russia knocking their production offline at the same time as all this is going on. The notion that we're just going to right back to where we were in February, seems to be prevailing as well.
Well, we couldn't any let's imagine magically, right? This very second peace breaks out. And everybody can trust it, and it's durable, and the ships just start moving right away through the Strait of Hormuz. Every analysis out there, including by JP Morgan, Goldman Sachs, the big houses have sort of figured this out too, because of the infrastructure damage that happened, like you mentioned in the Qatari side, right? The Ras Laffan unit there got missile attacked, and they destroyed two of these things that are called LNG liquefaction trains. And those are super complicated things. It's going to 2 to 5 years to rebuild those, right?
Right.
And so for sure, we're going to be facing that. Also, we have from the IEA, their chief said, Fadi Abiral said that about 75 things got struck that were related to energy in the Gulf. Some of them are oil fields, some are terminals, some are depots, but 75. We don't know how bad it is because somehow the United States has forbid the world from seeing any satellite imagery. You know me, I'm a ground up kind of guy. I've been scouring looking for any sort of imagery so I can begin to assess how bad is this. Someplace, maybe it gets fixed in a couple of weeks, but some of them, depending on what part of the refinery got hit, could be years. And we have fields that got shut in, okay, in Iraq and in Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Qatar. They had to shut their fields in, which is a no-no in the oil business. Because when you do that, when you go to restart them, rule of thumb, you can't get them quite back to where they were before because you've experienced reservoir damage. And how much, we don't know. We'll have to see. But the idea that here's minimum, it's going to take 3 to 6 months to get us back to maybe 80%. And that's if everything goes really well. If things don't go really well, we'll get back maybe 50, 60% of that within 6 months if peace breaks out right now.
Today. What did you
Today.
see the news today, Chris, about the UAE leaving OPEC on the 1st of May? What do you make of that?
I haven't seen that news yet.
Oh, well, there you go. All right, what would you think if the UAE left OPEC? Because yeah, that I didn't know if you'd seen that. That hit maybe an hour before we started recording this. They put out
Well, that would
this
be a big
announcement.
deal. That
That's
would be a
kind of a,
really big deal. So,
yeah, run with it.
okay. So, this is an unpopular opinion in some places, but so we do this decapitation strike against Iran. Within 5 minutes, they're firing missiles against all our bases. By the next morning, I'm watching videos of drones dialing into our radar installations. And so they blinded us. They took out all our key radar installations. We had 14 separate bases that range anywhere from completely destroyed to pretty messed up, right? And so I think NBC News even sort of added that up on Friday that last week and said, oh, yeah, this was much worse damage than we'd been led to believe by the US government because they wanted to keep that kind of hidden. So it's pretty clear that Iran has got had a strategy, been waiting for that moment. They didn't strike first. They punched back, and they've had this tit for tat game going on for a while. They say, hey, if you strike us, we'll do this. If you hit our desal plants, we'll hit yours. If you're supporting United States attacks in our country, you're going to be targeted, right? And so they've been playing a very measured game, but they put this thing out right when, remember last week, Trump's like, deadline, I'm going to bomb you back to the Stone Age kind of stuff. And Iran just said, hey, if you do that, we're going to hit the east-west Saudi Arabia pipeline to Yanbu. We're going to close the Red Sea Strait there, and we're going to take out Oman's pipeline as well. So that would have taken out another maybe 10 million barrels a day, taken right off the market. And so we're like, oh, okay. So we had to sort of readjust. I can't see. So the United States started the negotiations and came in and said, 15 points, agree with it, or we're going to kill you all, bomb you to the Stone Age, kind of thing. And we're not in a position to dictate. We're going to have to negotiate. And Iran came in and said, oh, well, we have our five things. One of them is you have to pay reparations for the damage you caused. You're going to have to like lift all the sanctions. We control the strait, da, da, da. We said those are completely unacceptable. So the two sides have completely non-overlapping sets of demands that they want to end this. This is called being very, very far away from a negotiated settlement.
So with
And if the United States gets impatient and decides it has to dial it up on them one more time militarily, this is when I'm going to be putting out another alert to all my subscribers, to the world, saying, run, do not walk. Things are about to go really pear-shaped at this point, because if we lose another 10 million barrels per day for an indeterminate amount of time, that's called worldwide global economic shock. And it's almost impossible to predict how that's going to play out. But Japan is heavily exposed to that. They are 100%, call it hydrocarbon dependent importers. They have none. They import everything. They got most of that through the Gulf. There's the United States, let me be clear about this, is in no position to supply Japan or anybody else, Europe, with what they actually need. We're still a net oil importer in this country. Most people don't know that, but we import oil. We export other stuff. But we put it all in one spot and call it petroleum, which is totally useless way to describe things. But yeah, we have a lot of propane and butane and stuff from our gas fields. But oil, we still import oil. We can't, an importer cannot supply the world with exports. It's just not how it works. So at any rate, if that happens, though, you and I both know that Japan is umbilically linked to the United States financial system. Can you imagine Japan? They've been working so hard to keep their yen under 160. They've been intervening like crazy. Their interest rates are getting away from them. They got this giant carry trade that's unwinding. They got so many pressures. $200 a barrel oil, absolutely, I think, sinks Japan completely. And I don't know if we can decouple our financial system from Japan's in time. I don't know if we have the necessary firewalls.
So, no, and they can't. And like, just, everyone that studies history, you remember that was all one of the parts of World War II, right? Japan knowing they didn't have any energy. And so they're expanding into Southeast Asia, right? Trying to find energy resources. And here we are, nearly 100 years later, and that hasn't changed. And that's just one example. And again, them as a could be a net, I don't know, we wouldn't want to say net exporter of treasure, but they could be a net seller. Do you kind of put all this together, Chris, with that? I mean, Hank Paulson kind of crawled out from under his rocks last, what was it, last week or the week before? I mean, I haven't seen Hank Paulson in over a decade, and all of a sudden he's talking about, oh, the US better have a backup plan for if suddenly there aren't enough buyers for all the treasuries.
What did you think of that? That was such an odd note in the symphony. I didn't know what to make of that.
It's a curious
You can't
timing.
take it at face value, right? You know they're trotting him out for some reason, right?
Right. I mean, and again, like the swap lines that Treasury has, and well, through the Fed have opened, sure seems like we're headed toward another great, like I said, monetization or whatever you want to call it. We spoke in January of 2020, and it was middle of March 2020 when all of a sudden on a Monday morning the Fed cut rates to zero, and there was an alphabet soup list of all these programs, of all these things they're going to buy to support the markets. From a big picture financial standpoint, and then the last question I have for you is a personal standpoint, but from a big picture financial standpoint, is that how this plays out again? Just like COVID, demand shock writ large, financial, got to provide as much liquidity writ large. I mean, is this going to be the biggest thing yet? I mean, remember we've joked it's like QE1 was 700 billion and then QE2 was 800 billion and then, QE3 and then COVID was 5 trillion. Is this now going to be 10 trillion? We've joked how they just keep getting bigger and bigger. Is that where this is headed?
That's exactly where it's headed. I
Okay.
can't see it any other way. And so the long history of the interventionist Fed was they did a little, it actually started in 87 with Greenspan and putting the put under the markets during that 25% down day in the Dow. And then, 1994, there was this intervention because there was a corporate bond market thing. It was bigger. Ooh, then there was 1998 with the long-term capital management. Oops. Then there was the dot-com bust. That was bigger. Oh, then there's the great financial crisis. That was bigger. Then there was COVID. That was bigger. If you look at each of those biggers, Craig,
Yeah.
they're roughly 2x to 3x bigger than the one,
Yeah.
the wherever the Fed balance sheet is. So right now it's say about 6.7 trillion. I could easily see it doubling or tripling. It's going to go to 12 to 18, something like that. And the Fed doesn't care that every time they do that, the financial survival line moves up another $50,000 of family income. They don't care. They're there to keep the system going, and they're going to
Yeah.
have to print and print a lot. And with those swap lines, that the weirdest thing to me is looking at treasury accumulation over time. You're like, how does Great Britain, how, where did Great Britain, where did the UK come up with $600 billion to buy our stuff? Where exactly did they get that money? The Caymans. Okay. The Treasury International Capital Report still claims that the Caymans are holding about $300 billion, and that's mostly in hedge funds and offshored, things for tax reasons. But there was that study that came out where they actually added it up, and they're like, oh, they actually, there turns out there's 1.38 trillion in the Caymans.
Four
Did you see
times as
that?
much.
Yeah. And they hadn't recorded it in the tick flows. I'm like, how is that possible? You have to, it's so simple. Where's the ownership of this particular CUSIP? Is it has to be a known thing because you have to know where
Yeah.
you're sending the coupon payment to.
Right.
You have to know that. They had to study it, and they suddenly discovered an extra trillion that they didn't know about coming out of the Caymans. I have my suspicions. I think we're due an audit of the Fed transaction level. Let's find out what's going on, because that sounds to me like stealth monetization's already been happening. But again, a little conspiratorial, but it's kind of sus. I'm like, did the hedge funds shake down friends and family and come up with an extra trill? It's a lot of money.
But it's everything is so, like you said, we joked about the gold and silver prices being faked, and the derivative trading being allowed to set the price of the physical. And now that, they've extended that into crude oil, obviously the derivative trading is setting the price of the physical, at least in the US. QE is nothing but a manipulation of of the bond market and interest rates. I mean, central banks have been intervening in Forex for as long as I can remember. I mean, are we now just down? I mean, is this just going to, the Fed now expands their balance sheet by $5 trillion to deal with this upcoming crisis. And, now, it's just bigger and bigger all the time. Does the whole thing just basically, I don't even know what the term is, Chris. I mean, it's like we all joke about like we're living in a simulation, the Matrix or the Truman Show or something like that. But it's almost like that's where we are.
It absolutely feels that way. It's become a narrative machine, not a it's they're not markets. That's why I often you're going to hear it in my voice, but I put quotes around markets when I
Right, with
talk about
the
them. Because a
air quotes.
market, an actual market, like the one my dad would understand, is a place where buyers and sellers freely come together to determine price. A market is a narrative machine that they use to reinforce narratives that are very important. We need the dollar to appear strong, so gold needs to be weak. We need to control the price of silver because whatever. Who knows why they focused on that one as hard as they did, but they did. But they found out with derivatives, they were able to control the price of pretty much everything. And the people I feel terrible for in this story are the producers, because wouldn't you know it, surprise, it's always the producers that get shafted in this
In the
story.
end.
Copper didn't change meaningfully in price, nominal price, for 20 years. Corn is the same price today it was 20 years ago. Think about the input costs being a farmer, right? Wake up yesterday, oh, 48% rise in bankruptcies and farms because, oops, fertilizer costs just doubled or whatever they did. And so that is part of the story, that the futures has been a great way to make sure the producers barely keep their nose above water, and then all the rest of the profits go into the machine. That's how they've been used.
Chris, I've kept you longer than I promised you I would. So I want to get to the last question, which is, again, we'll go back to, maybe I'll dig up the link and I'll put the COVID podcast link on here just so people, if they've got some extra time, they want to go back into the Wayback Machine and listen to what we discussed 6 years ago. But I remember there's a big pig. We got to warn you what's coming because it's clearly going to come. And one of the things that I remember discussing in that podcast, discussing with you, okay, what preparations can I take? I see this coming. What should I be doing now? Not just going to Costco and buying toilet paper before, the masses are forming a line around the block to go buy their toilet paper. What other precaution am I taking now for my health, for my family's health? We talked about, buying masks. You could put one on a sick person in your house while you care for them, that kind of thing, or the beta blockers that you could buy over the counter to help if you get sick yourself and you face a cytokine storm. We discussed all those things way ahead of everybody else. So, to that end, what should people be doing now? Obviously, it's a health issue, but from a not only personal protection, just personal, not even prosperity, Chris. What's the word I'm looking for? Just personal, not survival. That's too strong of a term. Just to make sure that you can subsist going forward. What should people be doing now?
Great question. So I can tell you what I've been doing, and the way I think about this is I guess the derogatory term is, oh, you're a prepper. What I'm doing is I'm building buffers into my personal systems,
Yeah, that's a good way
okay?
to look at it.
So that if all of a sudden, I don't know, there's an energy lockdown and food becomes scarce, well, I have a food buffer, right? In the terms of, I have stored food, sure, but also, I got a garden going and planted more fruit trees this year, so. Food and fuel, those are my two big things because that's actually what's been under attack. We didn't also talk about that the fertilizer that's missing, not just from the Gulf, but also, wouldn't you
Russia.
know it, Ukraine magically flew a bunch of drones into some of Russia's fertilizer plants. And so they
Jeez.
are now not exporting fertilizer
Oy.
anymore, principally, nitrogenous based. So there's going to be an extraordinary explosion in food prices over the next year or two. So anything people can do to build those two buffers, food and fuel. So what am I doing on the fuel side? I'm staring right now at a giant rack of what are called EcoFlow batteries. You can still get them, what I consider to be pretty cheap, relative to what they cost just a few years ago. And also pretty cheap considering that China is still sending them to us at this point. I'm a little worried that if this carries on, the one thing that really has driven a lot of my behavior is asking this question. What if China wakes up one day, decides the United States needs to be curtailed, and they don't want to take us on militarily? Obviously, what they would do is they would just say, we're just shutting down trade with the United States until y'all get a regime change or sort things out. But for now, we can't support you, because that's our Achilles heel in this story, is that we are totally dependent on stuff from China, including lithium batteries and components and electronics. And it's so many things, it's impossible to list them all. So I've been sort of operating as if, what if it, it's already, the term for this is the enshittification, right? I can't tell you how many times now I go to Home Depot and I just want this simple thing and they don't have it, right? Like, oh, we can order it and get it here in a few weeks. It's amazing how thin some of our supply lines actually already are for certain things. Particularly, I have a small farm. It's tricky getting things, at this point in time. And so I think that could go very rapidly if this goes to the next phase. Let's all hope it doesn't, but food and fuel are going to be the two very big things. And on the fuel side, listen, we all know we're just slamming in these data centers willy-nilly. We know that electricity prices in certain parts of the East Corridor of the United States have already doubled in the last 5 years, right? I mean, talking full 100% increases, and even more in some locations. We know that energy is going to get more expensive. So, you know what I did? First time ever, I bought an electric car, fully electric. And it was a Kia EV6. It's got 84 kilowatt hours of battery on board. So it actually can go both ways. I can charge the car up off of my solar panels, and I can plug in my freezer and refrigerator, literally plug it into the car, and it'll run them for, days. So I did that because no matter what, I have fuel coming off of my solar system that I can just keep this thing running indefinitely. So, by the way, I've never actually liked a car this much. I was never, anyway.
Gearhead.
Evie and I, we go shopping for a used one. I can't believe how cheap they are. Used, like 23 grand for this thing, right? Has 20,000 miles on it. We end up getting the EV6, which is a Kia, and they have different model lines. And so Evie just falls in love with the GT line, which is their sport line. Greg, 650 horsepower, 585 foot-pounds of torque. So this brings me back to my muscle car days, as a youth. But
Gearhead.
these are, anyway, this thing's like stupid sporty, but at all places along the curve, it has the same torque at 0 miles an hour as it has at 70. Like, it's the same response. Like, anyway, I think Elon Musk was onto something. Thankfully, he cracked that nut of how to get these electric cars back out. But now, for as long as the car doesn't break down, assuming, if the world kind of goes a little pear-shaped for a while, we can travel. So it's important. So that again gives me some buffer now. Now I'm not completely, yes, I still have, a Nissan Pathfinder, got a truck, got I've got diesel stored on the farm for the tractor and the skid steer. So that's what I've been doing, is just acting as if this is real. And even if it turns out I've been alarmist and I got it wrong, all that happened was I bought some things that I was going to use anyway.
What were those batteries, Chris? The
EcoFlow.
ego flow, eco flow.
EcoFlow.
What are they?
Well, EcoFlow is a company, and so you can get these different things, but what I got were the Ultras in some sort of a square rack-ish kind of a thing. They come in modules, so you have this invertery thing on top that then has batteries that you can stack as many as five or six underneath it. I have three under the one I'm looking at. And what impressed me about it is, so Nick, who works with me, he's the gearhead of all things electric and solar. So this is the model he settled on. And so good enough for him, great for me. But what I was impressed by is I just plugged it in and it turned on and it worked perfectly. And it was simple. And so what I do is I program it now to principally recharge itself from 10 to 2 when my solar panels are making more than my house can use. And then it just feeds, this one I'm looking at runs my studio. So it feeds my studio all the rest of the time. And so basically I'm getting pretty grid independent at this point in time
Sounds like
because of
it.
these things. Yeah.
Seems like that's a pretty good investment, regardless of what happens over the next 90 days. But you've laid out
Well,
a go
yeah.
ahead.
Well, I that's the one I'm looking at, but I bought three of these things. And so one is over And it's just dedicated and it's sitting there on my well pump because I've decided there's only three things that make us humans, running water, refrigeration, and music, So you need electricity, right? And so one of them is just dedicated to the well. And so if the power goes out, I'll still have water and same terms. And then I have another one dedicated for the three freezers that I'm maintaining. And that's its only job. It sits there, the freezers plug into it, it plugs into the wall, it recharges itself when the solar's up, and it discharges into these things. So if the power ever went out, really not a lot would happen to me here
Yeah,
for
I'm
a good
coming to
long
your
time.
house. Oh, so anyway, I'll be
Thanks.
there.
Yeah.
I'm gonna get
Yeah,
myself.
bring a trailer with a lot of stuff because we have an entrance exam at the gate. Yep.
add something to the community.
Yes.
Gotta be a
Yes.
net positive. Shoot. Well, Chris, I've kept you a lot longer than I promised you, and I want to thank you for being so generous with your time. I felt that this was important stuff to talk about. To get people, if you're not already looking over the horizon, to start thinking about it. Because again, the media, everybody tries to tell you, oh, yeah, well, the next headline's going to be positive and everything's going to go back to normal. Without, I mean, this shock hasn't even hit yet. And so I want to thank you, Chris, for taking some time to get everybody thinking, because I think this has been invaluable for everyone to listen to.
Well, thank you. And I don't want to be alarmist, but
How
I'm
can you
just like
not
that
be?
scene in The Big Short. No, sorry, Margin Call, Jeremy Irons, stabbing the table with his finger. This is it. I tell you, this is it. That's what I've been saying since the start of this thing. This is it. And we're in that awkward period before, Wile E. Coyote's run off the cliff, but he's still like treading air. That's how I
Yeah.
see it right now.
Yep. Like late January 2020. I mean, it, like I said, it's not the same, but it's a pretty good metaphor, facsimile. I don't know, something like that. I wasn't an English
Yeah, it's
major, were
close enough.
you? Anyway,
No. All
all right.
right.
Peakprosperity.com, peakfinancialinvesting.com. Our old friend Chris Martinson. You want to go more in depth with these details right there on the peakprosperity.com site. That report that Chris was mentioned about, what at least half of it is right there, public for people to read. But you want to go into, I mean, Chris goes into great detail on this stuff. So I encourage you to check out his website and his services. My friend, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. Really appreciate the opportunity.
And we'll try to stay on top of things. We'll have another midweek conversation for everybody, hopefully as soon as next week.